nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, welcome to today's Nanotechnology 501 lecture. Our presenter today is Professor Ron Reifenberger, professor of physics, and also one of the principal investigators in the NASA Center for Nanoelectronics and Computing. Known Ron for a while. His talks are always interesting and usually pretty entertaining. So with that, let's just welcome Professor Reifenberger.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure to talk to you about something that I really and truly enjoy talking about today. In particular, I've been asked to give a sort of an overview of scanning tunneling microscopy. Probably you're not going to learn anything new from this talk. It's more of an attempt to bring together and summarize a lot of the well-known facts in this particular field that's now almost 25 years old. Okay, so what I plan to do today is basically very quickly review quantum tunneling. This is probably something that most of you have learned about in your undergraduate physics classes. I like to introduce the concept of local density of states, which is a concept that's needed to understand what you measure when you do scanning tunneling microscopy. I like to summarize some of the very early results in the field of scanning tunneling microscopy and try to tell you why this field attracted worldwide attention way back in the mid-80s and try to highlight some of the important things that were discovered back then that turned a lot of us on to this particular technique. Since I'm an experimentalist, I like to tell you how to build one of these microscopes and explain to you some of the underlying principles that you need to understand if you use any type of scanning probe microscope. And then lastly, if there's any time left, I'll touch upon one topic that's particularly interesting to me. This is the topic of nanoscale, true nanoscale engineering, where you actually go and build things atom by atom. So I don't know if we'll have enough time to do the last topic, but if we do, I'll touch upon that. So first thing is just to briefly review what quantum tunneling is. This is an effect that was discovered or hypothesized back in the 1920s, actually. And the simplest implementation of quantum tunneling comes from just trying to understand what happens if you take an electron of mass m and you shoot it at a barrier. The barrier has a particular height, V naught. The energy of the electron is measured with respect to the baseline of this particular potential energy diagram. Classically, of course, you would expect that, classically you know that the electron cannot go through that barrier. It's going to be reflected at the position z equals zero in this particular diagram. But because electrons are quantum particles, right, they have wave functions, and these wave functions can interact with this particular barrier in ways that were not particularly intuitive back in the 1920s. Nowadays, of course, we think we understand this reasonably well. But the point is that everywhere in this energy diagram, Schrödinger's equation has to be satisfied. And Schrödinger's equation has a term in it which describes the potential barrier that the electron sees as a function of position z. And if you want to solve Schrödinger's equation for this particular barrier, the standard technique that all undergraduates in physics learn is that you set up three wave functions. These wave functions are labeled psi1, psi2, and psi3 in this particular diagram. And then what you do is you try to match the electron wave functions at the boundaries of the potential barrier. And in this way, you have a certain number of unknowns in the equation, you have a certain number of equations, and you can always solve for the unknowns. In particular, what we're trying to calculate in this particular problem is we're trying to calculate the transmission probability. In other words, the probability that the electron gets through that particular barrier. And the way that problem is typically solved is you define in quantum mechanics a current operator, right? And the current operator is defined in terms of the wave functions in different regions of that particular barrier. And in particular, the transmitted current is given by this rather complicated operator that we're just going to hypothesize. We're not going to derive it. And we can work out an expression for that transmitted current. And interestingly enough, it involves this parameter D, actually involves the magnitude of that parameter D. And that parameter D is just the coefficient that's multiplying the wave function psi 3 in this particular slide. So that coefficient D that multiplies the wave function psi 3 there, that's an important parameter that tells how much current is actually transmitted through the barrier. If you actually want to find the transmission probability, you have to take the transmitted current divided by the incident current. And I work out the simple expression for the incident current. When you take the ratio of the incident current or transmitted current to the incident current, you get an answer that just depends on the square of that coefficient D. And the answer to that question, what is the probability that the electron goes through that particular barrier, the answer is a rather complicated formula. It involves parameters that are related to the energy of the electron and the shape of the potential barrier, right? So now, that complicated expression can be further simplified if you make the assumption that one of the parameters alpha times the width of the barrier d, small d, right, if that quantity is much, much greater than 1. Now, that the physical consequences of that assumption are that the barrier is wide, okay, and the energy incident of the electron energy incident on that barrier is very low, right? And when you make that that assumption, you can simplify the hyperbolic cinch term, and you get an answer that the transmission probability is a bunch of parameters times e to the minus 2 alpha d, right? And that's the important formula that you need to understand to appreciate scanning tunneling microscopy. If you now go back and you insert realistic parameters and try to calculate alpha, what you'll find is that alpha is a number, and it's a number on the order of 20 to 25 inverse nanometers, right? Now, that number is important for a number of reasons. First reason that's important is that if you change the thickness of the barrier, in other words, you let D go to D prime, where D prime is one angstrom bigger than D, right? If that parameter alpha is on the order of 20 to 25 inverse nanometers, what that works out to be is it works out to be a factor of 10 change in the transmission probability, right? So if you have a barrier that's, say, 1 nanometer wide, and you make it 1.1 nanometers wide, just a 10% change in the width of the barrier, the transmission probability for the electron to go through that barrier goes down by a factor of 10. So for a very small change in the width of the barrier, you get a huge change in the transmission probability, right? So the implication is if you can measure the transmission probability very accurately somehow, some way, then you can measure with extreme precision the width of the barrier, right? And that's the key to understanding scanning tunneling microscopy, all right? The next thing to say is this is a very nice model calculation, but it's very difficult to realize experimentally. And the reason is that if you try to bring two metals close to one another and have a separation D between them, and if you want that separation D to be on the order of a nanometer, it's extremely difficult to pull that off, right? Because you need two atomically flat metal substrates very close to one another. And experimentally, that's difficult to achieve. And we'll talk about that as this talk evolves. The other complication is that real metals are not nearly as simple as these square barriers that we all deal with in textbooks. Real metals involve atoms, and these atoms tend to modulate the electrostatic potential that an electron sees. And this modulation in the electrostatic potential that an electron sees shows up as very sharp spikes in the potential. The spikes are separated by the separation between atoms in the metal, which is on the order of 3 angstroms. And so these simple, the consequences of this fact, right, the consequences of this very complicated potential now, is that the simple-minded wave functions that we use to set up the square barrier, right, they're no longer applicable. You have to cook up much more complicated wave functions to get a realistic approximation for an electron traveling in this realistic potential. All right, now how do you get around that problem? Well, what you do is you use some insights that are gained from the previous example. Right, that's the simple way to get around it. Right, what you now do is you say, well, we're going to have a wave function for an electron, and that wave function could be extremely complicated. Thankfully, I don't want to know what the wave function is inside the metal. I want to know what the wave function is somewhere inside the vacuum gap, right? Inside this tunnel barrier that's formed between two metals that are brought about a nanometer far apart from each other. And so what you then do is you say, well, the wave function at some distance z outside this metal is going to be equal to the wave function psi at z equals 0, which is at the metal surface, times some exponentially decaying function e to the minus alpha z, where this parameter alpha is defined here in terms of the simple square well barrier. But in reality, it could be a little bit more complicated than that. You know, right now we'll treat alpha as a parameter, an adjustable parameter, right? So since once you know the wave function, you can find the probability of finding an electron at a particular point in z, right? The probability that you find a particular electron at a particular point in z is just the square of the wave function. That's another fundamental result from quantum mechanics. You can then say that the probability that you see a wave, an electron at some distance z from the metal, is just the probability that the electron is at z equals 0. And now we've got this parameter e to the minus 2 alpha z, where the 2 comes simply by squaring, right, this wave function up here, right? So this looks something very similar to what we derived when we did the square well potential, right? We've got some number. In this case, it's psi naught squared, something that we don't really know what it is. But it's multiplied by this exponential factor e to the minus 2 alpha d, which is an exponential factor that we know from solving the square well barrier problem, okay? Now, to make current flow between the two metal surfaces, this is the next step in scanning tunneling microscopy. What you have to do is you have to apply a potential difference between the two metals. In this case, I call the potential difference just E, the charge on the electron, times delta V. And what this serves to do is it serves to move the electron states on the left side of this diagram up by a small quantity. The states on the right side of the diagram are not moved up. There are unoccupied states on the right that the electrons can move into. And so they tunnel through this barrier, right, in the same way that electron tunnels through the square well barrier that we started discussing this problem with. Right? They tunnel through this barrier. And you can define a current that flows. And the current that flows is going to be related to the probability that the electrons in the shaded region on the left get to z equals d, the metal surface on the right, okay? And we can calculate that quantity, right? It's gonna involve a sum over all the electron states in that shaded region of the diagram. So let's say we've got n state. Let's say each electron has a wave function psi sub n, right? We have to sum up all those electrons. The sum is gonna range over the shaded region in the diagram. And each electron wave function squared is now going to be multiplied by this exponentially decaying function e to the minus 2 alpha n d, right? That's going to be the total current that flows. So theorists are very clever people, right? They recognize that that summation is a very complicated thing to calculate. So what they then do is they define something called the local density of states. And they define the local density of states in terms of this parameter rho, which is basically a sum over all wave functions in a metal surface over a small energy range epsilon, right? And this parameter rho is now referred to as the density of electron states at a particular point in the metal for electrons with a particular range of energy epsilon about some energy E that you might be interested in. Okay? So that's a formal definition of the electron density of states. This local density of electron states has a few very nice features. And the bottom line for this particular discussion is that with a little bit of algebra, you can rewrite the current that flows from one metal surface to the other. When you bias the two metals by a potential difference delta V, you can write that current I in terms of the local density of electron states rho times the potential bias that's applied times this e to the minus 2 alpha d factor that we learned about when we first did the square well problem. Okay, so the important thing to remember is the current that flows is somehow related to the electron states over a narrow energy range on one of the metal surfaces from which the current is flowing. Right, and that's an important result because when we do scanning tunneling microscopy, this local density of states that I've tried to define in a very simple way here, that's going to be the key factor that allows you to determine whether electrons flow or not flow. So if the local density of states is high for a particular energy, you would expect a lot of current to flow, right? If you could measure the current that flows at that particular energy, you would expect to see a high current. If the local density of states is low, the current should be correspondingly small. So that's an important result. Now, since I'm an experimentalist, these are nice things to discuss, but the question is, how would you measure something like this? How would you measure a local density of states? And the answer to that question historically is what you do is you perform something called a field emission experiment, in which you take a metal plate and you hold a metal plate centimeters away from, let's say, a very sharp tip. You put a very high potential difference between the tip and the plate. This potential difference causes the potential energy diagram to assume this triangular shape that I've drawn here. And because the width of this potential barrier is now finite, right, there's a finite region here, electrons can tunnel out from the metal into the vacuum. And you can actually catch them in free space, and you can measure how many electrons come out as a function of energy, let's say below the Fermi level of your metal surface. Right? Now the number of electrons that flow out at a particular energy is going to be somehow related to that local density of states that we defined. And again, the idea is simple, that if there's a range of energies here where the local density of states is high, then you're going to get a large contribution to the total current that flows out from that narrow range of energies. So that's the idea, right? This is the one of the papers that actually implemented this scheme. This goes back into the middle 70s, and I'm just presenting this to give you some idea of where the scanning tunneling microscopy community sort of came from in a certain regard. A lot of people that moved into scanning tunneling microscopy understood this concept of local density of states, and they understood how to measure local densities of states using these so-called field emission experiments. This is a very busy slide. Okay, the bottom line is that you can measure the shape of the electron current that's emitted. You can compare the shape of that electron current that's emitted to standard models, where you assume a local density of states that's uniform over energy. And if there's a region in energy where there's an enhancement, right, in the electron current. That enhancement has to be related to a local density of states at that particular energy for the metal that's emitting the electron current. And so this paper actually goes back and uses the band structure of the different metals and uses that band structure to interpret the extra current that's emitted over certain energy ranges in field emission experiments. So that's one very key experiment that was done. Okay, now that experiment does not require a controlled vacuum gap. It just requires a sharp tip and a metal plate that's a few centimeters away separated from each other in vacuum. And the question is, if you wanted to actually now measure the local density of states as a function of position over a flat surface, how would you do it? Right? That's a really important question. And the answer is it's hard, because if you just take two metal surfaces and you bring them up close to one another, the metal surface is rough. It's rough on the order of nanometers. And two metal surfaces brought up close to one another will have a variable gap that's very ill-defined. And when you bias, let's say, the blue and the yellow surface by a potential difference, you can get a current to flow, but you're not going to understand what the current's due to, because you have no control over the gap. All right, so experimentally, that's a bad situation. Our friends Binning and Rohrer, who invented the scanning tunneling microscope, got around this problem in 1981 by realizing that if they brought a very sharp tip up to a metal surface, that the just the process of forming the sharp tip might, if they were lucky, it might allow you to define a separation gap that's well defined between the two metal surfaces. Right? So now, in this situation shown on the bottom of this slide, there's a gap, there's a separation, there's a vacuum gap between the two metals, and it's well defined. It's a number. You may not know what it is, but at least it's well defined. And so the next question then becomes, okay, if you think you can form this type of a structure experimentally, put a bias voltage between the two metals, measure the tunnel current between them, and ask the question, does the tunnel current vary exponentially with the distance d between these two metals? Right? That would prove experimentally that you've actually achieved the geometry that you're pretending that you have. So this gets us to the start of STM in 1982, right? This is a very simple experiment that was performed by Binning, Rohrer, Gerber, and Weibel over in IBM Zurich Research Labs. They took a sharp tip, they moved that tip close to a substrate, they had a bias voltage between the tip and the substrate, they measured the current that flowed as a function of displacement, and the data that they obtained is shown on the right hand side of this graph, where they're plotting the log of the current over about three or four orders of magnitude versus the separation d between these two between the tip and the substrate. And what they showed was that the current does in fact depend exponentially on the separation between the tip and the substrate. Right? The fact that the data shows a straight line, those are like four or five different experimental runs they performed. Basically each experimental run can be well represented by a straight line. Maybe the slope is a little bit different, but that proved to scientific community that they actually did have a controllable vacuum gap. They could change the separation between the metal tip and the substrate, and the tunnel current varied by precisely the way that they expected it to. Right? Now, when a lot of us saw that paper, we were absolutely amazed and astounded that you could even control two metal surfaces to such precision in 1980. That you could actually acquire data like this, right? Because the clear implication is that the separation between the tip and the substrate had to be on the order of a nanometer or so. And so you had to have the ability to position the tip within a nanometer of the substrate. You had to hold it there, and then you had to controllably move it up and down. Right? Experimentally, that was really hard for a lot of us to believe. But Binnig and Rohr believed it, right? And they very quickly realized that, well, you know, if we have this gap now between the tip and the substrate that's tunable, right? Why can't we hold that gap fixed, right? And once we hold that gap fixed, then D is fixed, and that exponential factor, e to the minus 2 alpha D, becomes a constant. And what we can then do is we can scan the tip over the substrate, and we can, let's say, for instance, measure fluctuations in the tunneling current, because the tunneling current is gonna depend exponentially on this tip to substrate separation. The way that the tunnel current varies is exquisitely sensitive to small variations in height between the tip and the substrate. So the thought was, if they could build a circuit or build an experiment where this tunnel current is fixed, then as they raster the tip over, let's say, a substrate that has steps in it, right? Every time the tip would jump over one of those steps, the tunnel current would change. You then have to have a circuit that readjusts the tunnel current to keep it a fixed value. In the process of trying to keep the tunnel current fixed, you're literally moving the position of the tip up and down. And so what you're actually doing, if you think about it, is you've got a microscope now, because you've got an instrument that's capable of monitoring the up and down, the gentle ups and downs of a substrate, by just monitoring the tunnel current that flows between the tip and the substrate, right? So they took this idea of a tunnel current that was controllable, and they quickly morphed it into a microscope, which would be capable of imaging substrates at a very precise level. So when they did those experiments, this is the sort of images that they got, and they just shocked the world when they started to show these pictures. This first picture over here on the far left is actually an image that we got in our lab back around 1987. It's a picture of a gold substrate. It was obtained by insisting that the tunnel current be held fixed as we move the tip across a substrate. And this actual picture was recorded on a chart recorder. In those days, we didn't have computers fast enough to record the data. So this is actually a bunch of line scans that we recorded on a chart recorder. You can then plot it out, and you can start to visualize features on the substrate. And when you start to calculate how big these features are, you find out that they're on the order of a fraction of a nanometer. And that these steps are actually steps that are atomically high steps in the surface of gold. So for instance, the smallest step here, right, it's easy to show that step height is about 0.23, 0.24 nanometers, which is just the separation of atomic planes on the gold 111 surface. Right, all these other steps that you see are integer multiples of that smaller step. Right, so Binnig and Rohr pulled this off in 1984-1985 time frame. So they had a microscope that was capable of resolving sub-nanometer steps on a surface, okay, just by monitoring tunnel current due to this quantum tunneling effect that we discussed at the early part of the talk. So once you can do this, right, then computer technology takes over. Within a few short years, we were able to take these plots here that would literally require hours to obtain, right? You could speed things up, and you could then start to plot your data on computers. You could then use computer graphics to enhance the images and start to manipulate them. And I just show a couple of examples of other scans that we achieved here at Purdue, where now you can start to visualize these atomic steps on gold surface. All these are pictures of gold, just different levels of visualization. But the whole idea comes about because of this exquisite control that you have on the position of the tip just by monitoring this tunnel current. That's the key thing. The other experiment that really astounded the world was that Binnig and Rohr quickly reported that you could see individual atoms with this scanning tunneling microscope. And no one could understand how that could possibly be, but one experiment that was reported very early on was the imaging of periodic bumps on a highly oriented pyrolytic graphite substrate. The crystallographic structure of HOPG is well known, right? I've got a very complicated diagram that shows that. And the images on the bottom actually show scanning tunneling microscope images of HOPG. The image on the left is the raw data. That's the data that comes out of the microscope. And it's really a fluctuation in the current, the tunnel current, as you raster the tip across this very flat, inert graphite substrate. And just with a small amount of filtering, you can then clean up that image and you can start to see this very nice periodic array of atoms. The atoms are arranged in a hexagonal network, and the periodicity of that hexagonal network matches very well with the features of the lattice that I've got drawn. All right, so the two amazing features of the early days of scanning tunneling microscopy was, one, that you could control the tunnel current, right? That was amazing. And then, two, that if you controlled it well enough, you could actually start to see individual atoms on surfaces of metals and semiconductors, right? Truly, truly remarkable. So the question then becomes, why does this work? A lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about it, and basically what people realized was that the tip, which we tend to draw as, or we tend to think of as just an amorphous collection of atoms, right? The tip really has one atom that protrudes farther from all other atoms, right? And when you bring that tip close to a flat substrate, it's the tunnel current through that front atom that dominates the total tunnel current that flows. Now, granted, there are contributions of tunnel current from all other atoms in that tip, but again, remember, that contribution is going to scale exponentially with distance. So if let's say this atom here is one angstrom higher than this atom here, then the tunnel current that flows from that particular atom is a factor of 10 less. So all the tunnel current is being dominated by electrons that flow through this front atom into the substrate. And the reason that was then given to explain how you could achieve atomic resolution was very simple. It was, you were just basically taking one atom and you were transporting that one atom across a substrate, which in itself was composed of a periodic array of atoms. And it was the slight modulation in the tunnel gap between the front atom of the tip and the flat substrate that produced this very beautiful atomic corrugation that allowed you to see atoms right before your eyes. Okay, so that was a very key result. Okay, when people realize this must actually be what is happening. Okay, a couple of very important experimental results that Binnig and Rohr achieved early on that sort of convinced everybody that STM was for real, that it was not just a fluke. What Binnig did in one day was he set out to image the position of atoms on a silicon 111 surface. Now, this particular surface had been studied since roughly 1950. And if you survey the literature, you will find that there are probably 1,000 papers written trying to understand where the position of atoms are on silicon 111. And every paper written came up with essentially a different answer. Even in 1980, the answer to the question, where are the atoms on silicon 111, that the answer to that question was not known. So this is the paper that Binnig and Rohr published in '83, This is their original data. Again, it's taken on a chart recorder, right? And if you stare at it very carefully, you can see periodic arrays of bumps, which are telling you straight away where the atoms are located on silicon 111. Okay. The picture on the right is a figure I got from the web. It's from IBM's website, and it shows you in this orange color motif, it shows you where the position of the atoms are on silicon 111. And it's very complicated reconstruction. The process of forming this surface, the surface atoms rearrange ever so slightly, right? And they arrange in this very complicated but very periodic fashion. And this covers the entire surface of silicon 111. Okay. Just to show you how good the agreement was between theory and experiment, I just copied this paper from Tromp's PhysRev letter, or PhysRev B paper in 1986. What Tromp did was he took the top five or six theories to explain where the position of the atoms were, and then he compared the positions from those theoretical predictions to the experimental values that Binning and Rohr measured, right? And the experiment in this picture is shown by the dotted line. The solid lines are the predictions of various theories, and there was only one theory out there that actually matched that matched the experiment extremely well. That was the theory by Takayanagi, right? And that's shown on the bottom part of this, the lowest trace on this slide. You can see there's significant deviations between theory and experiment for all other experiments, or all other theories. So this was a truly remarkable result. In one day, one afternoon, Binning was able to solve this problem that others had been working on for about 30 to 35 years using this scanning tunneling microscope. And in my opinion, this is one of the prime reasons why they got the Nobel Prize in 1986, because they showed you can take this very simple instrument, use it to solve very complicated problems. The other result that really caught a lot of people's attention was a result that was performed by Randy Feenstra, who was then a research scientist at IBM. Feenstra realized or recognized that you could actually start to identify the chemical nature of individual atoms on a surface by studying the bias dependence of the tunnel current between a tip and the substrate, right? And so what Feenstra showed was not only could you resolve atoms, but you could color the atoms such that you could identify their chemical nature. Right? And so this is a paper that was published in 1987 in Physics Today, right, where Feenstra colored the gallium atoms red. He colored the arsenic atoms blue. This is an STM image of gallium arsenide. So again, this really caught people's imagination, because now you could do, literally, you had the potential of identifying atoms on a point-by-point basis. You could identify their chemical structure. So that was a significant breakthrough. And it was another reason why STM just grew exponentially throughout the world, because it demonstrated a capability that was not possible before this particular instrument was invented. So what is a microscopic view of what STM imaging does today? This is the idea. Basically, the substrate is viewed as a periodic array of atoms, and the tip has a front atom, and the electronic nature of that front atom in some way determines the type of image that you get from this microscope. So I sketch out a variety of images. I got this from Chen's book in 1993, where clearly if the front atom of the tip has an S-like electron orbital on it, it's going to image the surface in a different way than, let's say, if the front atom on the tip has a D-type orbital, right? And so now it becomes important, if you're going to do very, very careful work, to not only have a clean substrate, but also to prepare tips in which the front atom is known, and the electron orbital that's doing the imaging of that, that's performing the image of this substrate, you have to know something about that. So if you want to know what the frontline researchers in STM are doing today, they're trying to control the front atom of the tip so that they actually know the electron orbital that's overlapping with the electron orbitals, the local density of states of the substrate, right, to produce the image. And that's sort of the forefront research going on throughout the world today. So the bottom line in STM, scanning tunneling microscopy, the bottom line is the front atom is important, right? You have to know something about that atomic orbital, that there's a tunnel current between that front atom and the substrate. That amount of tunnel current depends on the local density of states of the substrate, right? And that embodies in a very simple picture what STM does and how it works. Okay, so there's two laws of STM. I try to tell my students this, right? First law of STM is every good tip ends with one atom, right? And how to prepare that tip that ends with one atom, that's still an art form, right? It doesn't always work out that way, right? But when you get a good tip, the images that you get are truly remarkable. The second law of STM is that good data nowadays requires ultra-high vacuum, right? Because, as all of you probably know, anytime you have a metal substrate or a semiconductor substrate and you bring it up in air, it's immediately contaminated with layers of hydrocarbons and oxygens and whatever, right? And so if you've got a layer of smog, let's say, that coats your substrate, then that layer of smog obscures the local density of states of the substrate that you're trying to image, and what you're going to measure is just junk. So the way to get around that is you got to put everything in ultra-high vacuum. You have to prepare very clean surfaces. You have to prepare very clean tips. Right? That's what makes this difficult and expensive. So, in the few minutes I have remaining, I'd like to just talk about some of the experimental aspects of scanning tunneling microscopy. And since I'm an experimentalist, we had to work through a lot of these issues in order to make this experiment work back in the 80s, right? It wasn't nearly as obvious now as it was. It was not nearly as obvious as then as it is now what you have to do. First of all, let me say that scanning tunneling microscope is just like any other scanning probe microscope that you've used. It has a lot of very similar characteristics, right? And in particular, it's going to have a scanner that allows you to move a substrate in a controlled way in X, Y, and Z. It's going to have a sharp tip. It's going to have some sort of a transducer that measures the separation of the tip from the substrate. In our case, in the case of scanning tunneling microscopy, the signal transducer is just a tunnel current that appears between the tip and the substrate. You're going to have controls in computers to maintain, in this case, a constant tunnel current as you move the substrate underneath the tip, right? And the motion of the substrate in the Z direction, right, that's required to maintain a constant tunnel current, that's going to give you your topographic information. So to maintain this current constant, you've got to move the substrate up and down in a controlled way. And by monitoring how much you got to shift the substrate up and down, you can actually then image the substrate with the tip, get beautiful images. So that's the theory, the schematic diagram. This is a practical example, right? This is a microscope that two of my students built in one day, just to show you this is not very difficult once you understand what you're doing, right? We literally just used parts that were laying in the scrap bin of the shop. And what this picture shows you is that there's a sharp tip, which is located above a substrate. The substrate is mounted on a piezo tube. The piezo tube allows you to wiggle the substrate back and forth in X and Y. It also allows you to move the substrate up and down in the Z direction. So it gives you the XYZ control that you need. The sharp tip is approached to the substrate by a simple micrometer. The tip is mounted on just a piece of PC board, right? So it's not anything fancy. And then of course you have some interface to electronics, which I don't show. So this is literally something that you could build in a day, right? And when you, the end of the day, you could then put a piece of this highly oriented pyrolytic graphite in, right? The data is a little noisy. This is out in air. It's not nearly as controlled as you like it to be. But I think if you stand back and you look at that image, you'll see that there are periodic arrays of bright spots which indicate the position of atoms on this HOPG substrate as this tip is rastered across the substrate. So for a few hundred dollars, you can see individual atoms, right? It's something. We were pretty excited about it. Nowadays, that was then, this is now. Nowadays, most of these experiments are done in ultra-high vacuum chambers. The reason you have to do them in ultra-high vacuum chambers is you need very clean substrates, you need very clean tips. You have to have pretty sophisticated sample insertion techniques. You have to have the ability to clean your sample off after you insert it, right, to boil off any hydrocarbons or oxides that may have contaminated the surface. And then you need your scanning tunneling microscope, which in this picture is shown on the far left of this image. So everything else is just preparation, right? Everything else is just preparation. All the physics and the microscopy are done in that small chamber. Nowadays, it's very difficult to build good microscopes with graduate students. And in the 1980s, we could be competitive. Nowadays, we can't. We cannot compete with the German engineers that crank these microscopes out. So in our instrument, we actually bought an Omicron ultra-high vacuum scanning tunneling microscope. And I show the schematic diagram of it plus a photo of the actual microscope itself. All right, so this is a very nice piece of equipment. And I'll try to show you a little bit about its stability as we move through this. One question that's always asked is, how do you achieve this vibrationless motion of the substrate with respect to the tip, right? The implications are simple. If the tip is a nanometer above the substrate and you're moving the substrate by hundreds of nanometers, you can't have any vibration between the tip and the substrate. If you do, you're finished, right? So how do you achieve that? Well, the way Binnig and Rohr did it is they used piezoelectric bars. Right, piezoelectric bars are bars of ceramic such that when you put a voltage across them, they either expand or contract depending on the polarity of the voltage that you apply. Right, and so in the early days, everybody would be cutting ceramic bars out of big discs of ceramic, piezo ceramics, in order to make tripod XYZ scanners. They would be basically three bars oriented in orthogonal directions to give you the X, the Y, and the Z motion of the substrate with respect to the tip. Right, nowadays, everyone's switched over to piezoelectric tubes. Piezoelectric tubes are a lot more compact, right? You can get much larger displacements of the piezo tubes for the same applied voltage, right? And you'll find that all the scanning probe microscopes on campus today are basically outfitted with these piezoelectric tubes. Now, there are problems associated with piezos, and I talk to students all the time who show me images, and the students fail to take into account these well-known problems of piezo ceramics when they interpret those images. And in particular, there are two problems associated with piezoelectrics that I like to discuss. One is referred to as piezoelectric creep, and the other is referred to as piezoelectric hysteresis. Piezoelectric creep simply means that when you put an abrupt change of voltage on your piezo, there's an abrupt change in the dimension of the piezo followed by a much slower creep, right? That much slower creep, when you follow it through, it produces distortions in your image, which I try to illustrate over here in the upper right-hand corner. So if you're trying to image a square block and your piezo is undergoing creep behavior, the black line in that image shows you the profile that your microscope will give you, even though what you're trying to image is square, right? So you see this all the time in images that you get from atomic force microscopes. The other issue is hysteresis. Hysteresis just simply means that when you ramp the voltage up, you get one expansion. When you ramp the voltage down, the contraction is different than what you got going up, right? The implication of that, if you sit down and follow it through, is that if you're trying to image a square object on a substrate, the actual profile that you measure will be distorted. The profile on the right, after you've swept over that block feature, that profile will be lower. It will appear lower than it actually is because of hysteretic behavior. How do you control the tunnel gap? Well, you do it simply with an operational amplifier and a feedback circuit, right? So what you typically have to do in this business is you have to build a current to voltage converter, which has a gain of about 10 to the ninth. You can then use the voltage output from your, this is an electronic circuit. This thing called A in this picture converts the current flowing through the tunnel gap into a voltage with a gain of about 10 to the ninth. You can send that voltage back to an op amp and use it in a feedback circuit in order to adjust the position of your tip in order to maintain a constant difference between some set voltage and the voltage that you actually are measuring from your tunnel current. All right, so this is a very, very simple technique. Graduate students can build circuits that do this quite readily. It's not overly difficult. You have to understand a little bit about feedback control. I've learned that physics students aren't taught this. This is much more a subject that's taught in mechanical engineering, but it's actually a negative feedback control mechanism. And the basic idea is simple. You want to have, this is your, the dynamical system in this case is your STM. You want to have a control law or control algorithm that maintains the output of your system as close as possible to the input of the system. And this control law typically has three parts to it. There's usually a proportional part, a differential part, and an integral part, right? So the control law usually has a certain signal that's proportional to the tunnel current, certain signal that's proportional to the integral of the tunnel current, and a certain signal that's proportional to the differential of the tunnel current. If you add those three things up, then what you can do is you can minimize the air signal E in this diagram as a function of time, and that allows your tip to monitor or to follow the contours of the substrate in a very controlled way. So there's a few different scanning modes, right? One is a constant current scanning mode, and the other is a constant height scanning mode. Right? This diagram, I just try to show you the tunnel current and the motion of the tip as you go over a hypothetical substrate and try to give you an indication of the types of images that each of these two modes might produce. There are also imaging artifacts, right? It turns out every microscope has imaging artifacts, and scanning tunneling microscopy is no exception. Here I tried to list three or four of the more important imaging artifacts. One is that if you have a very sharp feature in your substrate, that sharp feature in your substrate will actually image your tip, right? So the actual image that you get as you raster the tip over this very sharp substrate, the actual image you get is an image of your tip and not of the substrate, right? So that can be very confusing. You can also have this tip dilation. Right, the tip dilation simply means that if your tip is anatomically sharp and you're imaging an object which is not atomically flat, then the image of the feature in the substrate is broadened by the dimensions of the tip. So this is a common principle of all scanning probe microscopy. Every image that you see is always broadened laterally because of the finite dimensions of the tip. It's called tip dilation. You get double tips, right? When you make these tips, you have no guarantee they're going to be sharp and end with one atom. Sometimes you can have tips that have two protrusions. Each protrusion images the features in the substrate in a different way, right? And so you'll find out that your entire image is actually a sequence of double images, right, when you look at it. And then lastly, a wide tip. If your tip is too wide to get into features of the substrate, then the depth of the feature of the substrate becomes inaccurate. So we can talk about vibrations. I'm quickly running out of time. This is a real puzzle to anyone who thinks about this carefully, right? Let me try to explain it very, very quickly. You can go and you can buy accelerometers that measure the vibrations of the floors in your lab, right? And these accelerometers basically tell you the velocity of the floor as a function of frequency, right? So you can make these plots. The particular frequency, you can find out how much your floor, or what the velocity of your floor vibration is. So you can take a very simple model and you can interpret this velocity in terms of a displacement. And that's what I've tried to work through here. I don't have time to go through the numbers, but if I just take this data point here indicated by the red circle and work through what that implies, I end up with a number that says that there's about 37 nanometers of vibration on the floor, right, at 10 hertz for this particular lab. This is my old lab in physics, turns out. Now, how in the world, if the floor is vibrating at 37 nanometers, how in the world are you going to see atoms that are only about 50 picometers high, right? How can that possibly be, right? But yet it happens. I mean, these are pictures of atoms. The atoms you can measure are 50 picometers, but the whole floor is vibrating, right? So that was that caused a lot of us to scratch our heads back in the old days. But clearly what you have to do is you have to vibrationally damp those floor vibrations out. In the old days, we used to do it with series of springs, right? If you used one set of springs, the floor was vibrating by a magnitude delta Z naught, you could quickly show that the sequence of springs that you used to isolate your experiment from the floor reduced the vibration by some factor alpha. So if one set of springs is good, n set of springs is better. And so if you just follow this logic, you would find in the early days that many of these scanning probe microscopes were isolated from the floor vibrations by a sequence of 3 to 5 spring systems, each of which caused an attenuation alpha. So the net attenuation was alpha to the n, right? And you could achieve factors of 100 or so vibration isolation from this very simple technique. Nowadays, of course, there are buildings that are being built to specifically address this problem. And what I show here is I show the attempt that Purdue has made to solve this problem permanently. This is an ultra-quiet space in the Burke Center. What we actually have is we have a 38,000 kilogram slab of concrete, which is isolated from the floor vibrations by 6 massive air springs, right? And this system allows you to reduce the vibration by about 2 orders of magnitude from the vibrations that you commonly find in vibration in labs throughout campus. So for instance, this is an example of my old lab over in physics. You can see all these spikes that come, they're due to the fact that there are motors in the attic that are running, there are elevators going up and down. There are people walking back and forth across the hallway. My students listen to music on their computers. Whatever the reason, they produce a lot of vibrations that this accelerometer picks up, right? The size of those spikes depends on the time of day and what's going on in the building. So it's very hard to do an experiment when you have that type of noise going on. In the Burke Center, this is an example of the vibration spectrum that was measured just a couple months ago in the middle of this massive slab. You can see about two orders of magnitude improvement in the amplitude of the vibration. And in particular, the thing I always remember is that above about 10 hertz, we have amplitudes of vibration of this slab that are less than 1 nanometer, right? That's truly a remarkable piece of equipment. And this is 24/7, right? This isn't at midnight. This is in the middle of the day. So you can now start to think about experiments in a way that we never were able to think about them in my old labs over in physics. So this is just a slide to show you the type of stability that we can achieve, right? What I show here is we just digitized the position of the tip above the substrate. We did it 3,400 times. We plotted up a histogram to see how accurately we could hold the tip above the substrate over a period of about 10 seconds. This is not state of the art. It's just a demonstration of what we can do here in our labs. What you can see is that the data fall on a very nice bell-shaped curve. The standard deviation of that bell-shaped curve is about 5 picometers. So the implication is that with this microscope, with this instrument, you can accurately maintain a tip position to within about 5 picometers over tens of seconds and allow you to make measurements of surfaces with that type of precision. So the last topic I wanted to just mention is a unique application of scanning tunneling microscopy. This is true nanoscale engineering, and it's the ability to move atoms with a scanning tunneling microscope tip. The first thing you might want to do is know why this is in fact possible. And on this slide, I try to give you an indication of why this ability to move atoms with a tip is feasible. The basic idea is if you bring an atom close to a substrate, you can measure the interaction force as a function of position. This interaction force is plotted schematically in the bottom left-hand portion of this particular view graph. Initially, the atom feels an attractive force. As you push the atom closer and closer to the substrate, that attractive force becomes strongly repulsive. When the interaction force crosses zero, of course, that's an indication of where that atom is going to rest above the substrate. And you can go to the literature and you can look and you can plot the position of various atoms on various surfaces. And I've shown this plot on the right-hand side of this view graph. And what you see is that for a wide variety of different atoms on a wide variety of different substrates, the bond length, the separation between the atom and the substrate is something on the order of 0.2 to 0.3 nanometers. And the implication of this is that if you could then bring it an STM tip with its front atom close to an atom, and if you could bring that tip to within a couple tenths of a nanometer, you would be able to perturb the force that atom feels on the surface on the substrate. And by perturbing that force, you could then possibly push the atom or pull it as you move the scanning tunneling microscope tip from left to right. So the basic idea is shown in the next slide, where we've schematically shown an atom, a red atom on a substrate that's in this diagram colored gold. The idea is simple. If you can bring the tip close enough to the atom within 2/10, 3/10 of a nanometer, there's going to be a net force that the atom feels towards the tip, and that force could literally pull the atom away from the substrate, attach the atom to the apex of the tip. In this way, you could You can manipulate the ad atom by either picking it up and moving the tip. You could manipulate the ad atom possibly by pushing or pulling it or sliding it across the substrate, in a sense generating a parallel force to push the ad atom as you move it. So that's the basic idea. There's recently been some extremely nice measurements that have been published, which discuss the relevant forces that the tip feels when it's brought very close to a substrate. And in this regard, the work that's come out of Peter Gruter's lab that I copied here is really very nice. On the left-hand side of this chart, you can see the two sets of measurements. On the bottom part of this chart is a measurement of the tunneling current versus tip sample separation. The tunnel current is plotted on a logarithmic scale, and there's about 5 or 6 orders of magnitude change in the tunnel current as the tip is brought from a separation of about 1 nanometer all the way into contact with the substrate. So in the course of about a nanometer, there's about 5 or 6 orders of magnitude change in the tunnel current. Now, when this measurement of the tunnel current was made, simultaneously they had equipment set up to measure the attractive interactive forces that the tip is feeling as it's pushed from this 1 nanometer up to essentially contact with the substrate. The data is somewhat cluttered. You have to sit and look at it very carefully. What I've tried to do is I've tried to faithfully reproduce the essential features of the data in the chart in the bottom right-hand corner of this view graph. And what you can see is as the tip approaches the sample, the tunnel current rises up into the hundreds of nanoamps, and the attractive force between the tip and the substrate then increases from zero, becomes attractive. There's something on the order of 2 to 4 nanonewtons of attractive force that pulls the tip towards the substrate. When you reverse the process, pull the tip away from the substrate, it's very clear that there's an adhesive, or that there's a metal neck that's formed, so the tip is adhesively stuck to the substrate. That's represented by the dashed red curve in the upper part of this schematic representation of the real data. There's also a very large hysteresis in the tunnel current, which indicates that there's now a metal bridge between the tip and the substrate. But the important point to take away from this is that the tip is in fact feeling forces on the order of nanonewtons as it's brought to within 2.2 to 0.3 nanometers above the substrate. And you can use these forces in very creative ways. And of course, number of very high-profile studies have been performed. I just sort of summarized very briefly these studies right here. The first one was the one performed by Eigler and Schweitzer in 1990, where they arranged xenon atoms on a nickel 110 surface. This experiment was done at low temperatures, and the xenon atoms were literally picked up by a scanning tunneling microscope tip and deposited in a recognizable fashion to spell out the IBM logo. About 6 years later, Kubrez and his co-workers actually moved C60 molecules, and they arranged these C60 molecules along the step edge of copper. They formed what they referred to as an atomic abacus. And then most recently, Manohran and his co-workers out at Stanford have moved cobalt atoms on copper 111 surface to form quantum corrals. And what these scientists have done is they've studied how electron waves reflect from this array of cobalt atoms that have been arranged in an elliptical form on the surface of an atomically flat substrate. So in my in my opinion, this is one of the unique aspects of scanning tunneling microscopy. It's literally nanoscale engineering. It's building from the ground up. And I believe the only way you can do this sort of work is using scanning probes in a very controlled and careful way. And it sort of demonstrates what might be possible somewhere down the line, maybe 10, 15 years from now. So to end this talk, I just would like to acknowledge some of the students and collaborators that have worked in my lab since we started working with scanning tunneling microscopes back in the mid-1980s. The students are listed first. Yung-Jung Lee built the first scanning tunneling microscope with me here at Purdue. Dick Piner, who's now at Northwestern University, was instrumental in interfacing the microscope to a computer, and he showed that computer control of scanning probe microscopes is in fact possible. Matt DeRoghi, Sung-Hun Hong, Andre Labonte, and Gabor Pizzota all were very interested in studying conduction of current through molecular layers that were deposited on atomically flat substrates. Joel Therian was a postdoc, worked in my lab for a few years, and he's now at University of Massachusetts Lowell. He did some nice work with scanning tunneling microscope investigating small clusters of silicon. Deepak Pandey's my current student, and he's still working on scanning tunneling microscopy of molecules that are attached to substrates with a scanning tunneling microscope. Through all this effort, we've had some valuable collaborators from Europe, in particular Spain. My good friend Julio Gomez Herrero has been an invaluable source of information over the years, and he has sent a number of students from his lab over to mine for short periods of time. And these Spanish students were Luis Vasquez, Javier Mendez, Oscar Costanze, Pedro de Pablo, and most recently Cristina Gomez. So I think my time is up. Thank you for your patience, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Yeah. Three.
First is how do you assure that your tip ends with one atom? First question. The second question is, how can you assure that your vacuum, you're talking about ultra high vacuum, how high would be adequate for your research for like people? Mm-hmm. The third question is, if I look at your vibration, your low frequency, all the larger than the 10 frequency, that you can mitigate power one. Very, very good. But low frequency, it seems you still cannot mitigate that. Could you elaborate a little bit?
Okay. Three questions. First question is, how do we know there's one atom on the end of a tip? The answer is we just keep trying. Right? The standard way to do this is you have to develop a technique to make the tips. If you make, let's say, 10 tips and try to image highly oriented pyrolytic graphite, and 6 out of 10 times you see atoms on highly oriented pyrolytic graphite, that gives you a feeling that about 6 out of 10 of your tips are going to be good. Right? And so you have to learn when a tip is bad and don't waste time on it. That's very difficult for new students to understand because it's dirty. I mean, you got to get in there and you got to do it, and you got to get that feel. It's not written down in textbooks, right? Well, it's hard to control. It's hard to control. The best labs in the world are using field ion microscopy to prepare sharp tips, right? Where in field ion microscopy, they actually pull atoms off the tip one by one by using a very high pulsed electric field. They try to shape the tip so that there's one atom on the apex. Right? That's very complicated. It's expensive. We don't do that here. Okay. Second question was ultra-high vacuum. Ultra-high vacuum, I think, is defined to be anything below 10 to the minus 9 torr. Our system is running in low to mid 10 to the minus 10 torr. We'd like to get another factor of 10. It's just a question of money. So we had a little bit bigger ion pump, I think we'd probably get that extra factor 10. Best labs in the world are 10 minus 11 torr. Okay. Vibrations. why don't, the question was, what do we do about vibrations lower than 10 hertz?
Yes.
Okay, that's an important question, actually. It turns out at a frequency of 10 hertz, basically the whole microscope goes up and down together, right? Because one of the principles of building scanning tunneling microscopes is that you got to make everything small, right? The smaller you can make it, the better. And the reason is, the smaller you make it, the higher the resonant frequency of the microscope is. And so now if you got a vibration at 10 hertz, but an internal resonance of your microscope is at 20 kilohertz, that 10 hertz vibration doesn't effectively couple in to a 20 kilohertz internal resonance of the microscope. So the low frequency things are equivalent to just a slow up and down motion of the entire microscope. It doesn't change the relative position between the tip and the substrate. They sort of all go up and down together. Doesn't bother you. Okay. Yeah.
My question is concerned about the comparison about two scanning probe microscopy, the FM and the STM. And I think for the FM, I think the common question, I think the same thing question over the whiteness of the tip, you know, the same thing, the tip. I think commercially available at the moment is between about 10 to 20 nanometer. So that's the only, do you have a very, it's useful to measure the thickness, but very, not very good to measure the resolution about the wide. And this is one of the comparison. And the second thing is compare the application for the soft material, for example, the biomaterial. You compare the STM and FM, and both of them, what's the advantage for STM compared to FM concentration?
Yeah. So the first question you answered yourself, right? The AFM is pretty good at measuring vertical. Yeah. The horizontal, features are distorted, yeah. Right? There are software techniques that allow you to deconvolute the tip shape from your image. It's all software. You can work it out in a computer program. So if you actually know the shape of your tip, you can apply this algorithm to correct your image, and your corrected image will then have a deconvoluted tip shape taken away from it. Then you start to get good lateral measurements in addition to the vertical measurements. So that technology is out there. In terms of what is the best instrument to use to study biology, none of the above, right? Early days, STM was used. Everybody got very excited because they thought they could image base pairs along DNA with an STM. I mean, for God's sake, if you could measure atoms on a surface, you surely ought to be able to resolve the base pair sequence on a DNA molecule, right? Wrong. The problem is that you have to image under a liquid. Right? Because as any biologist will tell you, DNA on a dry substrate is not the same as DNA under a liquid. So you have to devise techniques to image under a liquid environment. The problem then becomes that the tunnel current, which flows from the front atom to your substrate, is now flowing through the liquid, right? You basically set up an electrochemical cell, and you don't have any control of where the tunnel current's going to go. And so STM, I don't think, is a viable technique for measuring biological samples. It was tried back in the late 80s, early 90s, but I think it's basically been abandoned. The problem with AFM, if you're trying to image biology, is that most of the biological forces are piconewtons, and AFM basically works on nanonewton, in the nanonewton force range. So you're basically asking an AFM instrument to perform at a level that's maybe 100 to 1,000 times more sensitive in forces than the biological molecule can withstand. So, you know, a lot of these proteins and DNAs that take some a few piconewtons, they start to unfold or denature, and the force that your tip is exerting in atomic force microscopy is on the order of nanonewtons. So the images that you get out are going to be very distorted. And this is one of the forefronts of scanning probe microscopy today, right? Is trying to understand how to use AFM to get at biological materials. It really requires people that understand how the microscope works and try to devise new techniques, new scanning algorithms that allow you to dial down the interaction force to get reliable images.
Okay.
It also requires sharper probes, right? That's another important fact. So I don't think that's completely settled yet how to do that. There are a lot of ideas, but it's not routine. Still a lot of problems.
Can I just follow up on that real quick? So for these web surface compatible AFM systems that are commercially available, is that the solution that they've taken, software and sharper tips, or what is the innovation that's allowed that?
Well, there've been a couple of advances, right? When you image underwater, it implies that you're, first of all, this is off topic because this is AFM, not scanning tunneling microscopy. But when you image underwater, you have to put your cantilever in liquid. And the cantilever vibrates, right? And in the process of vibrating, it sets up all kinds of standing wave resonances inside that trough of liquid. And then it's very complicated to figure out which resonance is related to your cantilever, okay, and which resonance is related to some geometrical dimension of your reservoir. So that's very complicated. The other problem is that the Q of the oscillating cantilever goes way down. So in air, the resonance curve has got a width that's on the order of, oh, let's say 100 or 200 delta F over F. Center frequency, delta F is the width and F is the center frequency. When you put that cantilever in water, all the viscoelastic damping forces in water cause that Q to go from a couple hundred down to one or two, right? So the curve gets very, very broad and you lose sensitivity in that regard, right? And one way to get around this is to use the innovation that molecular imaging came up with. Stuart Lindsay at Arizona State, I think he was probably the first person to say, let's not vibrate the cantilever with a piezo, let's vibrate the cantilever with magnetic fields. Okay, that had a big impact because now instead of the whole cantilever going up and down, the chip and the cantilever itself going up and down, producing all this water waves, now you just got this little 100 micron cantilever that's vibrating a few nanometers. Right, that was a big advance back in the mid 90s. I think we're still waiting for new technology to come along to go beyond that. There's a lot of ideas that I've seen. A lot of them are very complicated. We're working on one technique here at Purdue. Arvin Ramon and I are working on what's called a parametric resonance AFM. Parametric resonance AFM allows you to produce extremely high Qs, and we think these extremely high Qs will survive when we go into a liquid. There's no reason why they shouldn't. This is just a developmental project. It's not really funded at this point in time, but that's what we're pushing on here. We're hoping to engage the biological community at Purdue to try to test these ideas out on good samples. You know, part of the problem is, you know, that people that know how to do AFM don't know anything about how to prepare biological samples, right? And the people that know how to prepare biological samples don't know anything about AFM. So very often you find when these two communities talk, it's like, it's hopeless. So we're hoping that Burke and Binley being next to each other, maybe that'll get the discussion going at a new level. But we've tried to scan dozens of biological samples in my lab over the years, and it's funny, the biologists walk in and they have a very definite idea about what the sample that they prepared is. And then when you show them what we're imaging, they refuse, I mean, it's like denial. They refuse to believe their sample is so messy, right? There's salt everywhere and it's just a mess. And it's just the different cultures, you know, that come together, and when confronted with reality, the biologist doesn't believe it, and we ask them to prepare the samples better. They don't know how, or you know, it's, you really need a very tight loop in order to make that work, in my opinion. So,
I
enough?